So we're looking here on slide 77 at the Passover had a fourfold structure: the small preliminary meal, the Passover liturgy, the main meal, and the concluding rites. And they also, that is part of this liturgy, was a remembrance of their exodus from Egypt. There's a whole thing they go through. The youngest child, the youngest son, begins the liturgy part asking the father, why is this night different from every other night? And we saw somebody ask that in the movie The Passion of the Christ. You know. And the idea behind that is that they are making that exodus present in time. So it wasn't just like a remembrance thing, but they're saying, why is this night? They don't say, why was that night different? They said, why is this night different? So they're kind of making that event present to themselves again in the Passover liturgy. And that's kind of like what we do with the Mass, too. We make the sacrifice of Christ represented to the Father at the Mass. So it's like you're at Calvary, only it's an unbloody sacrifice. So it's the same thing. Pope Paul VI wrote a beautiful encyclical called I forgot the name of it. I'll think of it. But it's on the Eucharist, and he makes the point in the first paragraph that it's the representation of that sacrifice.
At the Mass, we know it's real. We really are at Calvary because with God there's no time.
Right.
But in the Passover meal, well, they're remembering, but they're not really at that.
Right. Yeah. Right? Well, it's like everything else in the Old Testament and New Testament, you know? The Old Testament points to the New, and the New fulfills the Old. So you have these Old Testament types, like Isaac. You know, Abraham took Isaac up the mountain to sacrifice because God said, sacrifice your son. But then he doesn't do it. You know, God intervenes and says, you don't really have to kill your kid because I got to have a lot of people to fulfill my promise to you, and so on. Although he does offer his own son, Jesus, as sacrifice. So we see a lot of those kind of things. So there are types in the Old Testament that point to the fulfillment in the New Testament. Some are not what you would expect. Bathsheba is a type of Mary. And you say, well, how can she be a type of Mary, given the fact that she committed adultery and all the rest of that stuff, you know? Well, she was a type of Mary because when Solomon became king, she was the queen mother, and she sat at his right hand on a throne. He had a throne brought in for her. None of his wives had that privilege, but his mother did. And then it says that her role was to intercede on behalf of the people of Israel with her son. So she would take their petitions and then present them to Solomon for, you know, and that's exactly what Mary does. She takes our petitions and presents them to her son, Jesus. And so we see a lot of those kind of things in that Old Testament and New Testament. So anyway, getting back to what Benedict says here, it says the breaking of the bread took place before the main meal. The giving of the cup followed the main meal. So they had the unleavened bread part of it, and then they had the main meal where they ate the lamb, and then they had the cup that followed it. They had four cups of wine during the entire Passover meal. And so they would do that. The Eucharist of Jesus, therefore, was a constitutive part of a meal structure, but had a relatively autonomous existence and significance in contrast to the meal event. And then Jesus structured the Eucharist so that it could be autonomously removed from the Passover context without the loss of any of its own sacrificial significance. And we see that for the first time with the disciples on the road to Emmaus, where Jesus teaches them the scriptures and all the rest of that stuff, all the kind of things you do in a synagogue service, and then you stop and have the meal. and he confects the Eucharist and then disappears from their sight. But he's not gone. He left himself there with them in the form of the Eucharist. And so we see that kind of thing going on. And then this is a note. The action of Jesus was very important, especially since, as we saw in the tape of a modern Passover, when I first put these slides together, I had a video showing an actual Passover meal. And it was, and it's, and there was a fellow from the Jews for Jesus movement, and he was the narrator of it. And it was a really interesting thing to watch, because he showed how many of the things that happened during the Passover meal kind of corresponded to the crucifixion and that sort of thing. So that's what I'm talking about, the tape here. That's well, I don't even have the tape anymore, so I can't show it to you.
I'd like to do a Seder meal on Holy Thursday at St. John's one of these years.
Yeah. When Mary Beth and I were teaching CCD for the confirmation class, we did that. We got a shank of lamb and did the whole thing, and we had the bitter herbs and the apple thing they had to dip in. The kids didn't like the bitter herbs, but they liked the lamb.
Hey, it's part of it, kids.
Yeah. So it says the action of Jesus was very important. As we saw in the tape of modern Passover, there is no longer a sacrifice of the lamb, for there is no longer a Jewish temple. So a modern today Passover meal does not include a sacrifice of a lamb. They might go down to the store to buy some lamb, but there's no longer going down to the temple, cutting the lamb's throat and bleeding it, and then taking it home and roasting it whole with all of its innards and everything else in it. They don't do that anymore. They just go buy a hunk of lamb and, you know, bring it home. Because there's no Jewish temple anymore. So the Eucharist could be removed contextually from the setting of Passover and still made a part of a new kind of meal setting that retained the sacrifice of Jesus himself. And I think it's also important to point out that you look at all four Gospels, none of them mention that there may be a lamb there. None of them mention a lamb. I think we talked about that last time. None of them mention a lamb being part of the Last Supper Passover meal. And Jesus did that on purpose because he was going to be the sacrifice at that meal. And it would have been really confusing to have two different sacrifices at the same Passover meal. And a lot of people don't understand this, but, you know, in John's Gospel, it talks about when they brought Jesus over to the Praetorium, and the Jewish people didn't want to go into the Praetorium. If you remember, we talked about that last time. They didn't want to go in there because they would have been ritually impure if they did, and they would not have been able to eat the Passover. John makes a specific reference to that fact that nobody had yet eaten the Passover, although they had already done the Last Supper. So the Last Supper was on the day before. And so when Jesus was actually being sacrificed, the lambs were also being sacrificed at the temple. And so we see that kind of thing. So the Eucharist could be removed contextually from the setting of a Passover, but then you can put it into a different kind of setting. And instead of doing it once a year, which is what they did with Passover, you could do it every day. So they had to provide that kind of a setting. So as the church spread and the apostles spread the faith and the disciples went out and they ordained these men as priests, the apostles would go somewhere, ordain some people, start a church, and then move on and go somewhere else, do the same thing. But they would always leave behind, you know, priests and deacons and stuff to take care of the people and provide them with the Eucharist, which they, of course, always did. And so those are the kind of things that we see developing. So instead of a Passover thing that only happens once a year, we now have the ability to have the Eucharist every day. The same thing with Yom Kippur. the Yom Kippur, they did the forgiveness of the sins of Israel once a year for the entire Israeli community. And then after Jesus came, it became a one-on-one thing, which you could do at any time you needed to. You didn't have to wait till Yom Kippur to do it. So he kind of merged both the liturgies into the Last Supper, which was kind of cool. He always knows what he's doing. You know, it's really amazing. He never makes a mistake. Just, he's an amazing guy, you know. You got to learn more about this guy. You know, he's pretty cool. So Jesus introduced his Eucharistic prayer within the framework of the Jewish liturgy. And that made sense because he was Jewish. All the apostles were Jewish. We didn't have a Gentile become Christian until Cornelius was baptized by Peter, you know, several years later. So all the first Christians were Jews. And that's why when you look at Jewish scholars who become Christian and Catholic, they'll tell you that they didn't feel like they converted. They felt like they was fulfilled. Roy Schumann makes that point in his book. He says when I became a Christian, I had to convert and reject my Judaism. When I became Catholic, I became a fulfilled Jew. And I think that's a major distinction there, you know, because we don't deny our Jewish heritage. We rely on it. I mean, it's all part of salvation history, you know. God's at work in all. They were his chosen people. It's the law. So one way or the other, he's going to bring us together again. I don't know how, but we can't do it. He's going to have to do it. So he introduced his Eucharistic prayer within a framework of the Jewish liturgy. His crucifixion had not yet occurred, but had its beginning within this Passover liturgy, because when he conducted the Passover liturgy, he instituted the Eucharist. He said, "This is my body, which is given up for you. This is my blood, which is shed for you for the forgiveness of sins." And so he anticipated the crucifixion, but because he was God and, you know, he can do anything he wants, he was able to give them his crucified self and glorified self at the Last Supper, even though he had not yet been crucified. And a lot of our non-Catholic friends don't understand how he could do that. So how could he do that? Well, he's God, you know. He can do a lot of things that we can't do. Just because we don't understand it doesn't mean God can't do it. I mean, he's done a lot of things that we can't understand. He lets bees make honey. He lets mammals make milk. We don't know how to do that. So the church, as church, had not yet come into being. That wasn't going to happen until after the resurrection, when Jesus gave the apostles the great commission to go forth and teach all things that I have taught you. Church, in a narrower historical sense, does not happen until the attempt to win over Israel fails, followed by the destruction of the temple and the scattering of the Jews. So you can look at church in both ways, but our church actually began at Pentecost, with the Holy Spirit coming down, filling the apostles, giving them all kinds of gifts and abilities that they would need to spread the church. And it's amazing to think about it. You got 12 guys. He says, go into the whole world. So you send 12 guys into the world. It'd be hard to send 12 guys across the state of Texas and accomplish anything, much less across the whole world. But he did. He said, you 12 guys, go into the whole world and teach everybody. Make disciples of all nations. Now, you know, if you're an apostle sitting there and you hear this kind of thing, so you say, what? You know, you want me to do what? You know, but that's what he said. And so they said, okay, we know you're going to give us the gifts we need to do it, because otherwise you wouldn't tell us to do it. He never tells you to do something that's just impossible to do, right? So they marched out and did it. Thomas went to India and so on, went to Spain, and, you know, they went all over the place and spread the church, all without the Bible. We didn't have a Bible till the year 398. So imagine that. Jesus didn't say, go forth and write a Bible. He said, go forth and teach. Go forth and teach. Why would he do that? Why would he not tell them to write down all this stuff? Most of the people were illiterate. Okay? It wouldn't have done much good for most people. So he said, go forth and teach. Go forth and teach all that I have commanded you. And so they had to know all the stuff. And then John tells us in his gospel at the end, if you remember, that he didn't write down everything Jesus taught. There's a lot of stuff he taught that wasn't written down. It would have filled libraries if we wrote everything down. And so there's a lot of stuff that the apostles knew that we don't find in the gospels. Yes?
I don't know what kind of a question this is, but I wonder, Mary must have said a lot of things, but they're just not written down. And maybe St. Joseph, we have nothing that he said.
But yeah.
He was not before Christ.
Yeah, right. Well, he took it right. But Mary, right?
Yeah, right.
But well, there was a reason.
Well, you know, there's an interesting book that I just got. I haven't read it yet, but it's it looks to be very, very interesting. It's the idea that, you know, where do you find Mary in the Gospel of John? Because John took responsibility for her after the crucifixion. Yeah. So he lived with her for a long time. Now, what does she do? She lived with Jesus for 30 years before his public minister. Can you imagine living? First of all, you're immaculate yourself, right? So your intellect is not impaired. She's probably the smartest woman that ever lived, humblest woman that ever lived. And so she's sitting there. Her son is God. So she was able to have conversations with him that were probably more than just, what do you want for dinner, for 30 years. So you can imagine how much she learned from him before he ever started his public ministry. So I'm sure he taught her, you know, a lot of also what was going to have to happen to him to prepare her, because he knew how hard it was going to be for her to watch him go through his passion. But then after the resurrection, when John took Mary into his home, they had years together. Think of all the things she taught John that ended up being incorporated into his gospel. And so this book talks about, you know, how do you find the influence of Mary in the Gospel of John? And so I'm really looking forward to reading that. It sounds like it's going to be a really intriguing book.
Who's the author?
I don't remember, but I can put the note out to you when I get home. I can let you know who the author is and what the exact title of the book is. But it looks like it's going to be a really interesting book, you know. But anyway, so the church came into being in kind of two ways. It had a narrower sense, because at first there was an expectation that the apostle would still be Jewish. They would just now incorporate Jesus' teaching. And so they kept going back to the temple. You know, you read the Acts of the Apostles, they kept going back to the temple and teaching. You know, hey, I'm Jewish. I can go to the temple. I got temple creds. You know, I can do this kind of thing. It wasn't until later that they kicked him out and wouldn't let him come in. And then, of course, the whole temple got destroyed in the year 70. So there was all gone. So the Jewish people lost everything. They lost their temple. They lost their Levitical priesthood and everything else. And to me, when I see somebody who's an observant Jew today, who's still hanging on to that faith, I mean, I got to give you a lot of credit. You know, I mean, I can't imagine, after going through the Holocaust and all the suffering they did, you know, through the Second World War and everything, and then not having a land, and then finally getting one after the Second World War, and then having all the Palestine people fighting with them, and now Iran's trying to wipe them off the face of the earth. I mean, you know, to persevere in that faith, is just really miraculous. John Paul II used to commend him all the time for that. You know, every year, well, he grew up in Poland, and Poland's like half Jewish and half Catholic, you know, kind of a thing. And so he had a lot of friends who were Jewish. And so every year he'd bring them to the Vatican, all of his friends, throw a big dinner for him. And he'd tell them, be proud of your Jewishness. Yeah.
It was half Jewish?
Well, I don't know if it's half. I mean, I'm just speaking off the top of my head. I have no clue. I didn't take a census of Poland. But there were a lot of Jews there and a lot of Catholics there.
Yeah.
And so Benedict, he did a lot of plays. He was in theater and stuff when he was young. So he had a lot of friends who were Jewish. And but he'd invite them to the Vatican every year, throw a big dinner for them. And he'd tell them, be proud of your Jewishness, you know. So he would do that kind of thing. But it's with the church, you know, right after the resurrection, when Jesus gave him the Great Commission, that started the church. But then it started in earnest when everything in Israel came to a grinding halt, when the temple was destroyed, when Jerusalem was destroyed, the Levitical priesthood was destroyed, everything was destroyed. They had nothing left. You know, so all they have now is some rabbis trying to hang on to as much of it as they possibly can. And it's... excuse me. People really irritate me. So the church came about kind of in two phases. So that's kind of an interesting thing. And then the Mass. So now Benedict begins to get into the Mass itself and how that developed. There's also a fellow, Adrian Fortescue. He was a priest in England. Really, really smart guy. He was what they call a peritus at Vatican II. A peritus means an advisor. And he was probably one of the greatest liturgical scholars the church has ever had. He wrote several books. But he's got a really, really good history of the church. It's called by the Roman Rite. And in there, he talks about the development of all kind of things in the Mass, like the Kiss of Peace. Where was that? And it's interesting to read because he talks about how he moved all over the place in the Mass, at the beginning, in the middle, toward the end. You know, it was gotten rid of altogether, and you know, all kind of stuff. He's got a very interesting view of the history of the Mass. So if you want to read some writings on the history of the Mass itself, Adrian Fortescue is a really good guy to go to. He was just a simple parish priest in England. He had like three PhDs, but he never wanted to go to the Vatican and do anything big. They kept calling him, say, hey, come over here. And he said, no, I want to still be a parish priest. So he was a parish priest in a little country parish in the outsticks, you know. Really, really smart guy. But he's got some really interesting works on the Mass itself. So Benedict says that since there was as yet no independent Christian reality, just starting, you know, the term Christian wasn't even used until sometime in Antioch later on, but only a kind of open-ended form within Judaism, there could not be an independent, specifically Christian form of liturgy. That had to happen later. Because the only liturgies any of these apostles knew about were the Jewish liturgies, Passover and Yom Kippur, you know? So they had to kind of develop how they were going to morph into what became the Christian liturgy when they couldn't go to the temple anymore, when they got kicked out. And Benedict says that the real mistake of those who attempt uncritically to deduce the Christian liturgy directly from the Last Supper lies in their failing to see this fundamental point. The Last Supper... public safety message.
Amber alert.
Is that what it is? We got an Amber alert.
Yes.
got all kind of good things going on here.
COVID-19 vaccination.
Where?
Virginians 16 and above are eligible for the vaccine.
Oh, is that right? Okay, good.
Where is it?
Everybody 16 and above is now eligible for the COVID vaccine, according to the It's Alert. Okay, let's try to get back to the real world here. The real mistake of those who attempt uncritically to deduce the Christian liturgy directly from the Last Supper lies in their failing to see this fundamental point. The Last Supper of Jesus is certainly the basis of all Christian liturgy, but in itself, it is not yet Christian. It was a Jewish Passover setting. The act constituting the Christian reality takes place within the Jewish framework, but it has not yet attained a real form. There was nothing we called a mass yet at that time. A structure or a gestalt of its own is a Christian liturgy. So we didn't have a Christian liturgy yet. All we could do was fall back on what we knew from Judaism and then try to figure out where to go from there. Salvation history is still open-ended. It's not over yet. It's still developing. Okay. No definitive decision has been made as to whether the Christian phenomenon will or will not have to separate itself from its Jewish matrix as a distinct reality. So the apostles weren't sure, you know, where this thing was going to go as far as how to worship God. They were still struggling with that issue. The Last Supper is the foundation of the dogmatic content of the Christian Eucharist, but not the foundation of its liturgical form. And I think you can see that. The dogma is the Eucharist, but the liturgical form had to develop over time as the church spread. So the latter does not yet exist at this point in time. As her separation from Israel became unavoidable, because the Jewish people kept getting mad at him for talking about Jesus and were kicking him out and doing all these kind of things, the church had to discover an appropriate form of her own in which to express the reality that was bequeathed to her by Jesus. So they had the reality, and so what were those dogmatic things they had available to them? Well, you had the Eucharist established at the Last Supper. You had the fact that you could celebrate that Eucharist any time, which Jesus showed at Emmaus. Yeah, so he was the celebrant and the high priest at both the first Mass and the second Mass, so to speak. But we also had the institution of the sacrament of confession. Instead of once a year at Yom Kippur, it's now available. Whose sins you forgive, they should be forgiven. Whose sins you retain, should be retained. So if you had a sin, you go to the apostle, you confess your sin. And at first, from what I've read, they used to have like a public penance you had to do. It wasn't until later that they developed the idea of a private penance as well as, you know, private confession and stuff. For a while, they would kind of stand up and say, I did this bad thing, you know, I beat my wife or whatever. And they would flog you and tell you you were a bad boy and go say five Our Fathers and five Hail Marys or whatever, you know, and stuff. But it had to develop an appropriate form. So there was some discussion about what is appropriate. What does an appropriate form mean? How do we develop our own liturgy and still stay true to our heritage? And they spent a lot of time thinking about that, and it paid off if you think about it, because the whole first part of our Mass has all the same elements of a Jewish synagogue service. You know, so we didn't lose all that. We just had to learn how to incorporate it into a new liturgy. So this is a necessity arising out of the situation, but not a decline. This seems to me to be a crucial point. That's Benedict talking, not me, okay? He said, this seems to me to be a crucial point, not only for the debate about the liturgical form, but for a genuine understanding of the Christian reality. The idea that after Jesus there was an immediate decline in primitive Christianity, resulting in a hiatus between Jesus and the church, would still persist today, rests on the failure to take these facts into account. And we see some of this idea of the decline incorporated into some of the pseudo-Christian religions. I mean, the whole Mormon faith is based on the idea that there was this great apostasy at the very beginning, which lasted for 1,800 years until Joseph Smith came around and God finally said, well, I got to take care of this thing. I waited 1,800 years. It's not fixed yet. So now I got to fix it. So I'm going to make you a prophet. You know, we can get into that in more detail on a different day. But we see that kind of thing. So there was this misunderstanding, basically. So if this is the case, if these facts are not taken into account, there can be no direct continuity between Jesus and the church. This is also why the proclamation of the word has moved its center of gravity from the kingdom of God to Christology. In this situation, unity with Jesus has to be sought in that discontinuity which is manifested where the proclamation of the kingdom to Israel is left behind and the church of the Gentiles is embraced. So there was a proclamation to the kingdom of Israel, started with Abraham and kept on going. And, you know, you are my chosen people. And Jesus says in the Gospels, you go first to the children of Israel and then to the rest of the world when he talks to the apostles. And so there was this idea that there was he came to establish a kingdom within Israel. And of course, we had King David and King Solomon and all. But we had to leave that behind and figure out now how did the church of the Gentiles form? It didn't form as a kingdom like Israel did. It formed as like a community, not as a kingdom. And so that was a distinct, you know, change there. So it's important to understand those nuances of how the whole thing had to develop. So he talks about, he continues in his book, Feast of Faith, talking about the Apostolic Eucharist. He says the Apostolic Eucharist took place within the context of the community meal. This was where many of the teachings were given. So the early Christians, you know, a lot of them couldn't read and write. So that's why Jesus said, go forth and teach. So they would come together and the apostles would then teach. And they would teach the people. And then those people would then teach their children and so on. And then he would ordain men as, you know, priests and stuff. And then they would go on to the next community. But it was the idea of a community. So everything happened as a community. So they would come together for a meal. And then they would do their teaching and do the Eucharist and everything else. So that meal idea continued. But it was also a place where they were taught. It was like a meal, a lunch where you get teaching, kind of like a conference. You know how you have a meal at a conference? Well, yeah.
So is that what happened after Vatican II, that they emphasized community more than sacrifice?
A lot of things happened after Vatican II. Yeah. Not what the church fathers said to do, but just what actually happened.
But you wonder where they got that. Yeah.
Well, the idea from Bognini, you know. But that's probably where part of it came from. Because in the non-Catholic communities, it is a meal, you know. Because the minister will say, come up and get a wafer and some grape juice, you know. There's no reality there. It's just a memorial thing. So it's a meal. So quoting Sherman that he mentioned in the previous slide, so the primitive Christian community meal was not a repetition of the Last Supper of Jesus, which is not what Jesus commanded to be repeated. It was the continuation of Jesus' everyday table fellowship with his disciples. Faced with the issue of incorporating Jesus' twofold Eucharistic action into this community meal, the more obvious course was to insert the two actions together rather than to place them before and after their usual meal. And so Jesus would sit down with these apostles and have a meal, and he'd teach them during the meal. So they kind of continued that whole thing. So Benedict says, it is clear that Jesus' command to repeat the action does not refer to the Last Supper as a whole, but to the specifically Eucharistic action. When he says, do this in remembrance of me, he wasn't making it a memorial. He's saying, hey, do this the way I'm teaching you to do it. Remember how I am doing it, and then do it the same way yourself. Thus, the Last Supper was not repeated, and this in itself gave birth to a specifically Christian form. As it developed, they began to put some kind of structure to how they were going to do it. Instead of just being a meal, they began to also put some form and structure, because they were used to liturgy. The Jews had liturgy, you know, so they had to find a way to make this into a liturgy of some kind. An ordinary meal precedes the Eucharistic celebration back in those days. The Eucharistic acts, now joined together, follow in the form of distinct action framed and heightened by the prayer of thanksgiving, which is the Eucharist. In other words, the Eucharistic prayer. You know, you have the first part, then you have the Eucharistic prayer. Some, notably the Lutherans, suggest that nothing was instituted at the Last Supper and claim the Eucharist originated in Jesus' meals with sinners. They do not recognize the liturgical setting for the institution of the Eucharist, and thus its meaning and significance is diminished. They fold this into their doctrine of justification, namely the pardoning of sinners. And that's where you run into the problem. There's a difference between pardon and forgive. You pardon somebody and say, okay. You forgive somebody, it's forgotten. It's gone. And that's the big difference. In Luther's mind, he couldn't ever come to grips with the idea that God can actually forgive you and make your soul clean. To him, it was like a juridical decision, and that you kind of whitewash the soul. You're still corrupt, but you just kind of whitewash it with a juridical decision that says, I'm not going to look at your sins. But the book of Revelation said nothing unclean can enter into the marriage feast of the Lamb.
But he was so scrupulous that he couldn't.
Well, he was also kind of messed up. He had a lot of psychological issues as well as other problems.
Now, the Lutherans, they don't believe in purgatory, then. Do they have an idea of purgatory?
I don't know.
I don't think so.
I don't get the idea they do.
Probably not.
Lutherans in Wisconsin.
I don't know. I've never studied the Lutheran doctrine. Well, the problem is there are no Christian religions other than the Catholic religion that have a dogmatic foundation. None of them have a dogma that says you must believe this to be a Lutheran, a Baptist, or Episcopalian, or whatever. There's no dogma. The only two religions that have a dogmatic foundation are the Jewish religion and the Catholic religion. So that's kind of part of why you have 30,000 different non-Catholic denominations just in the U.S. alone.
And one of our friends told us the other day that after Vatican II, she took a course, and they told her there is no purgatory. So a lot of people haven't been to confession in 30 years.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of crazy because you know, mm-hmm. You read Paul's letter to Timothy, right in the very first paragraph, he says, please pray for my friend Oceanicus, or whatever his name is, that died. Why would you pray for somebody who's dead? You know, if he's in hell, it doesn't help him. If he's in heaven, he doesn't need it. I mean, So looking at the apostolic Eucharist, even though Paul says that those who approach the Eucharist in sin eat and drink judgment upon themselves in 1 Corinthians, and pronounces an anathema to protect the Eucharist from abuse, 1 Corinthians 16. Those who hold the Lutheran view see it as the essence of the Eucharist, that it is available to all without distinction and without conditions. At this point, it has little in common with Luther's own understanding of the Eucharist. So their understanding of what they consider Eucharist has evolved over the years as well beyond what Luther's ideas were. It's become totally symbolic. Nothing substantial whatsoever, in spite of what Paul says. I guess they don't
know. Jim, I learned one thing that it was, you probably have heard this, I think it's either like 47 years or 67 years after the start of the Reformation, right? Over 200 books were written on the Eucharist, on the meaning and symbology of the Eucharist, from Calvin to Zwingli to, you know, whoever in the Reformation.
Yeah, there was a lot of that going around. In fact, just a few years after the Reformation, I think it was like 10 years, they had this big convention, because Luther was getting really upset when he saw all the fracturing going on. I mean, they were just springing up all over the place. So he had this big, I think it was called the Augsburg Convention. And they came together. His idea was to try to unify all the non-Catholic people together and get a common understanding of the Eucharist. That was one of his objectives. Get a common understanding of the Eucharist and a common understanding of blah, 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 blah. Well, they couldn't agree on anything. They got so mad at each other, they wouldn't even shake hands at the end of the meeting when it disbanded, and they all went their separate ways. So it didn't really serve the purpose. And then later on, when he was close to death, Luther wrote a letter to his wife, who was a former nun, and he said he was sorry he had ever done what he did, because it was never his intent to see this kind of division.
Right, I heard that.
It was, he wanted to, you know, bring them together, and he wished he had never done what he did. But of course, it was too late then; it had already happened. But that's kind of sad, you know, because when you look at the Book of Malachi, God is very clear. I think it's in chapter 4.
But they don't have Malachi.
He said, God hates division. Simple little statement. He said, God hates division. And I'm going to choke.
Don't choke.
I almost went down the wrong way. So the Apostolic Eucharist, he's continuing here. He says, just as the Passover meal was celebrated in a clearly defined household, the Eucharist too. Remember, the Passover meal for the Jews was celebrated in their home, not in the temple, like Yom Kippur was. Okay. So the Eucharist too, from the beginning, had definite conditions for admission. From the start, the Eucharist was celebrated in what one might call the household of Jesus Christ, and thus it built the church. So you had to be admitted to the Eucharist. So that was when the idea of the catechumen versus the baptized started. So the catechumens were those who said, oh, I think I might want to become Christian, but they weren't baptized yet. So they would teach them, and the book they would use to teach them was the Didache. And the Didache was the first compilation of the teachings of the apostles that was ever put together. It was done because, well, they asked the apostles to kind of help put it together, because they were going off into the world. They were going to do what Jesus said, you know, go forth into the world and make disciples of all nations. So they were out there doing their thing. And so they put the Didache together. And so the Didache was a collection of the teachings, but it also served as what you might call the first RCIA manual. Okay? And so all the teaching was done one-on-one. You didn't have a CCD class or an RCIA class. You had a one-on-one thing. So somebody would say, gee, I think I want to become Christian. So they would get assigned to a Christian as their teacher, and they would use this Didache to teach this new person. Well, as they were beginning to do their teaching, they were called a catechumen. So they were not allowed to come into the meal where the Eucharist was. They had to wait, And so after they were baptized, then they were able to come in and receive the Eucharist for the first time. And that's why today we even have the Mass of the Catechumens, and they symbolically say, okay, all you catechumens, you got to get out of here. You know, you go out, and then they come back, and all this kind of stuff. It's all kind of a memorial of what that was going on. But the people understood the importance of the Eucharist and how special and precious it was. And, you know, like what Paul says, if you abuse it, you abuse it to your condemnation. And so somebody had to actually accept the teachings and then get baptized before they could receive their first Eucharist. So that was the thing there. So the liturgy is not a repetition of Passover, for Passover was celebrated only once a year. It does retain the festive atmosphere and the precise admission conditions. You should not receive the Eucharist unless you are baptized Catholic and you're in good standing and have been to confession and all the rest of the stuff, you know?
Yeah,
and believe what they teach, right. That's why Cardinal Burke just recently put his letter out. I think I sent it to you guys. From Apostolic times, it began to construct its own special form. So starting with the apostles, what that liturgy looks like began to take shape and form. And by the year 700, it was pretty much in its present form. And then at the Council of Trent in the 1400s, Pope Pius V established it for good. He wrote a document called Quo Primum. I don't know if you've ever read that. Quoprimum. And in this document, he says that the Mass as we have it now shall be the Mass for all time. And that if you have a community that has a liturgical form that's at least 200 years old, you can still follow that form. Like the Augustinians had their form of liturgy, and there were a few of them that had a liturgy that was at least 200 years old. So they could still do that. But everybody else had to celebrate Mass according to the way it was defined at the Council of Trent. And at the end of Quo Primum, he says, this is the Mass for all time, and it shall never be changed. If anybody does change it, I call down anathema of Peter, Paul, and all the apostles on anybody who dares to change this Mass. Interesting. So when Vatican II came along and they started making the changes, that's the first thing people said.
Right.
What about Quo Primum?
Uh-huh.
And the excuse was, well, no one pope can constrain any other pope. So as long as the pope approved it, they said it was okay.
That was the rationale?
That was the rationale, yeah. So in spite of all the anathemas and everything else that St. Pope Pius V put on this, that was the rationale for allowing it to change. And forget about Quo Primum. But it's a pretty strong document. And it's got all these anathemas and everything else, you know, if you change the Mass and everything. Now the one thing that was always provided for, of course, was to change the calendar of saints to incorporate the new saints and stuff. And Pope Pius XII had started taking a look at some of this himself, because he wanted to... He was looking at taking parts of the Mass that should be said in the vernacular.
Oh, really?
And but he never finished that work.
Mm-hmm.
He was looking at, like, the Gospel and stuff like that, you know, the Gospel and Epistle. And it kind of made sense when you think about it to do that, you know. Yeah, because it wouldn't make sense to preach the Gospel in Latin,
right,
if nobody knew Latin. That was the common language back when it started. But then it was no longer the common language. And so Pope Pius XII was looking at making some of those kind of common sense changes. And that's basically what the fathers at the Vatican II said.
Right.
that said retain the Latin wherever possible, and only only translate the prayers in the vernacular where it makes sense to do so. And that was their instruction.
Right.
Just do some translating. That's it, period, you know. So anyway, so
the Latin Mass compared with the Mass now is so is different, especially giving the back to the tabernacle.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's very different today. Yep, it's very different today.
And then why the traditional Catholics are not too eager to go to the new Mass that we have now, and they really are they really are with the Latin Mass instead of the traditional the this Mass. I'm sorry.
Yes.
The Mass that we have. That how is that they don't accept the new Mass to compare with the Latin Mass, and I have been in the Latin Mass and it really looks, I really like it, that it's more adoration and feel like really with God in there, and it's not.
Yeah, in fact, a few lessons ago, we did a whole lesson on the traditional Latin Mass and what the differences were. The prayers of the Latin Mass are beautiful. So from apostolic times, they had to start coming up with a new construct. And the Jewish calendar of feasts is replaced with the new calendar celebrating celebration reflecting Jesus' entry into salvation history. So the new calendar looks at the new saints and recognizes their role in salvation history. And then Sunday, the day of resurrection, became the new matrix of the Eucharist, replacing Saturday as the day of the Lord. So the Sabbath is still Saturday. But when Jesus rose on Sunday, we made that the new day of the Lord instead of Saturday. So the post-apostolic Eucharist, this comes from Feast of Faith as well. The community meal is meant to open the door to the Lord, and it became an occasion for egoism. What he means by there is that some people took great pride in the fact that, well, we're going to have the Eucharist at my house today. And so if you had a very nice house, you would try to get everybody to come to your beautiful, so that all walk in, oh, what a beautiful place, you know, and all kinds. So it became a kind of an ego trip for some people. And so that became unsuitable. So thus it became unsuitable as a preparation for the meeting with Christ. Because, you know, you don't want to go on an ego trip and say, okay, I'm going to, you know, pay attention to Christ. This led to the separation of the meal and the Eucharist, and Paul talks about that in 1 Corinthians 11. He says, have you not houses to eat and drink in? Go there and do your eating and drinking, but come here to do the Mass. This development took place at a different speed in different places, but signified the transition into the third phase in which we are still today, where we come to church and have Mass, we go home and eat. It's no longer part of a meal service. So it's 10:30. We're going to stop here. Pick up with 86 next time. Anybody have any thoughts or questions or anything?
So yeah. That started way back in Corinthians when they separated the meal from the...
Yeah. Yeah, back in Paul's time. There, so because of the ego thing.
Right.
So Paul saw that. You know, he didn't like that. Because he said you got the wrong focus, and so they started trying to have what they had as their liturgical celebration separated from a meal. Because
so, Jim, when were churches then?
Built.
Maybe where and when were churches specifically built?
That all started after Constantine became emperor of Rome. because up until the time of Constantine, the church was being persecuted. So they couldn't build any churches. And so it was after the time of Constantine when he made the Christian religion the official religion of the Roman Empire that they were able to then start building churches and then saying, okay, now come here to do Mass instead of doing it somewhere else. This is where we're going to now.
So they were first built then in Rome or in Italy?
Once Constantine made it the official religion of the Roman Empire, they started building churches across the entire Roman Empire. So they were building them in England and Italy and Germany and France and wherever the Roman Empire was, Constantinople, wherever the Roman Empire was, that's where it was being built. They were being built. And so we see some cathedrals today that are really very old because they started, you know, building things back then. So that was what happened. But until then, until Constantine came along, you know, they couldn't do that. So when Constantine's mother went over to Jerusalem and found the true cross, she had to bring it back, and so they would then keep it housed in a church or a cathedral somewhere.
I'm wondering when the idea of seminary started, because in the early church, I'm sure they would just word of mouth, and went to the apostles and learned.
Yeah, the apostles would teach people, and then once somebody understood, they would then ordain them.
So when did they build, starting, you know, mass teachings of priests?
Oh, I don't know.
I have no idea.
I don't know.
I wonder.
It's a good question. We'll look that up.
I'll ask Father Smith.
I doubt if he knows. I doubt if too many people know when the first seminary was formed. You know,
yeah,
I have no idea. We'll have to look it up. Do Google.
Go to Google. I don't know any of that stuff.
Just ask Google. Or ask Siri. When was the first seminary formed?
Yeah.
So, anybody else have any questions? Okay, we shall close for today. Thank you, everybody, for coming.
Thank you.
No, thank you,
and
Jim.
We shall...
Thank you, Jim. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Have a great week.
And
yes.
We shall...
Have a blessed week.
Ready you too.
Love you and God bless.
Everybody, have a great week.
Yeah.
Love you.
Love you and God bless.
God bless.
See you next week.
Okay.
It's so wonderful. It's such a backpack.
I know. I love this.
So it's so detailed.
Yeah.
So if I get your thoughts and can return them,
yeah.
It's wonderful.
That's the other part that's good about this movie.
Right. That's a little far. Well, I know the basics. I know how to play.
Have a good week.
Thank you. God bless you.
You too.
You know,
no, a couple of years ago.
You think your body is
what
it used to be 4 years ago.
Or last year.